Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 to 13 times for at least. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations who got the money. That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't even communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate them. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March for what? Who cares? Marches never changed anything.
Oh,
many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I will be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But, man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No. Nope.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Here we are on 3rd of February, 2022. Today's podcast is titled, and this is Slave Entrepreneur Month. Most people have Black History Month, but we're concentrating on African Americans, black folk, whatever you want to call us, who started out the majority of the people that we're going to feature, maybe not all. But so far, we've been keeping in that vein. This is we're celebrating Slave Entrepreneur Month, and these are people that are primarily that were born legally slaves here in the United States, and they were now this is something they were legally allowed to partake in the free enterprise system. And when they decided to do that, and they started their own business, some while enslaved, legally speaking, and some became wealthy. And some were social entrepreneurs, we'll go into that later. But anyway, so we started off a couple of days ago with Mother Priscilla Baltimore. She started off life as a slave, and she, while as a slave, she was earning money, she was getting paid, so that's a myth buster because a lot of people think that all slaves were not paid. She was paid, and as we talked about Monday and yesterday, and we'll do it all through this month, many slaves, how did they earn money? They were artisans. They made things. They manufactured things. So Mother Priscilla Baltimore earned enough money to buy out her freedom and get legally free. And then she organized what I would call a social enterprise. A social enterprise. She got together with 11 other families. They went over to Missouri and bought land and started a what was called then a Freedom Village. They started their own town. Today it's known as Brooklyn, Illinois. Yesterday, we talked about Junius George Groves. He was known during his time as the Potato King. He was a prolific grower of potatoes, and from what I read, on the planet. He, too, also started off life as a slave, and he became wealthy. He became rich. Now, today, the slave entrepreneur that we're going to feature is Edwin R. Overall. Edwin R. Overall, and in our program notes here on Blog Talk Radio, slave entrepreneur Edwin R. Overall, energy CEO. He became an energy CEO. So we're gonna get through what he did. So we're gonna take a walk down through Faith Street and then come back and we'll discuss our featured person of the day, and we're going to be doing one, we're going to be featuring one slave entrepreneur per day. So by the end of this month, for you know, because we just do it Monday through Friday, we don't do weekends, we'll have at least 20 different slave entrepreneurs. We can do a one really for every day of the year, but we're just going to restricted to, since this is February, we don't celebrate Black History Month, but our genre is slave entrepreneurship. So we'll be back right after we take a walk down Faith Street.
Now learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know. He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is, when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it, because your package gonna go right on by. You can't lose your faith and and get on Not Meant to Be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box going to get sent back to sender. And now you're going to have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he can fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad cap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come. We get high.
I used to observe that a lot of those shacks used to be by the track where black people were.
With the room in the back.
Yes, with the room in the back. That was a safety net.
Yeah.
Where black people who would move here and there and go from here and there and looking for jobs, that's usually why we move, and the jobs would play out like they always did.
And do.
But we had a place to go when the sun went down. But now, those shacks by the track don't exist anymore. They came and built highways right alongside of those railroad tracks where those shacks used to be, super highways. So now, if you get on a highway, you might notice that if you, sometimes you are right alongside of a railroad track. You see trains passing
that
as you were driving.
That is true.
Down a super highway.
Mm-hmm.
Well, see, those highways used not to be there in the northwestern hemisphere. It used to be shacks along there. A lot of those shacks were on what we call railroad property. But the railroad people, the people that ran the railroads, didn't care much because nobody wanted to be down. That wasn't prime real estate.
No.
Nobody wanted to be by the tracks anyway. So black people used to build those shacks around there back when black people knew how to build shacks. Black people don't know how to build anything now because they used to build places for white people, but they cut them off, things called unions, took them out, took the carpentry all out of the schools and all like that. So how many black people do you know that know how to fix anything now? It used to be thousands and millions of black people that know how to build a house from scratch out of old pieces of lumber.
Wow.
A lot of people don't remember that. Most people are not that old to have seen it done. I'm old enough to remember when many black people used to get together on a Saturday afternoon. That was the only time they had off, or sometimes, or on a Sunday sometimes after church. They would get together, six or eight of them, and go down and build what they call a shotgun house. It wasn't much, but it was a roof over your head, a good solid roof. I've been in some of those houses, raised up in some, all right? They were excellent, solid houses that could stand a lot of storm and rain. They weren't much, just maybe three rooms. But I've been in some of them. There were many, 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 many of them. But along came the white supremacists and say, these Negroes know how to build stuff. We're going to fix that so the next generation won't know how to do anything except stand in front of a place that is built and big, because they won't know anything about carpentry or masonry or how to make anything with their hands.
All right, that's Neely Fuller on something culturally we in the United States used to do on weekends. Hopefully we can, not hopefully, we'll get that restarted. All right, today, well, once again, this is Slave Entrepreneur Month. We feature, our goal is basically to feature one slave entrepreneur per day. But today I might go a little bit over that. Now, our featured slave entrepreneur for today is Edwin R. Coverall, and then our blog talk title is Slave Entrepreneur Edwin R. Coverall, Energy CEO. And we'll get into that in a moment. But let me read this to you. Profit-making businesses were created by more free and enslaved African Americans than one might realize from the unusual survey of the antebellum America. When the opportunity presented itself, it was taken by these men and women, sometimes timidly, sometimes wholeheartedly, and often endorsed by the masters of the enslaved. Now, let me read part of this again. Profit-making businesses were created by more free, and here's the operative word here, and enslaved African Americans than one might realize during the antebellum America. This gives you a clue into, and I think it's a positive clue too, into the positivity of the United States free enterprise system, where even an enslaved person could start a business. Now, today, we'll give you a little bit about Edwin R. Coverall, who later became an energy CEO. But, and I typically keep it, so far I've been keeping it to one a day, but today I'm going, before we get to Coverall, let me put out some more examples out here. A tobacconist, and that's spelled T-O-B-A-C-C-O-N-I-S-T, tobacconist, hopefully I'm pronouncing it right. This is about Lunsford Lane. Lunsford Lane, L-U-N-S-F-O-R-D, Lunsford Lane, L-A-N-E. As a young slave, Lunsford Lane recalls selling a basket of peaches for money. He can keep that he can keep, and very soon, says, his plans for making money took the principal possession of my thoughts. In 6 to 8 years, he had amassed $1,000, enough to purchase his freedom, as we read in the narrative of Lunsford Lane, 1842. Abraham Lincoln's nowhere on the scene. This guy started off selling peaches. All legal and above board. And he purchased his freedom. So look it up online, the narrative of Lunsford Lane, 1842. Another person, now they made their money with shoemaking. William J. Brown was born into a free black family in Rhode Island, and as a young man faced discrimination and often unethical treatment from whites as he strove to pursue a trade and career. In his selection from his Life of William J. Brown, Providence, Rhode Island, in 1883, we read his frustrating experience as a store clerk and an apprentice shoemaker. Okay, so William Brown was born into a free black family. All right, let's see, what else do we have here? Another person that made their money as a barber. As being emancipated by his master in 1820, William Johnson became a successful businessman in Natchez, Mississippi, operating a barbershop, loaning money, and acquiring real estate. He became a slave owner himself, not a rare occurrence among Southern free blacks. Selections from his daily journal and account book are presented here in a glimpse into the mental machinery of this intriguing man. That's William Johnson. All right, so he was cutting hair. Other guys started selling peaches. The other one, now here's another one. Now, this guy was born free. Milton Gibbs was a merchant. Milton Gibbs became a businessman, lawyer, politician, and abolitionist. For several years, he operated a clothing store in San Francisco, which he learned from the his autobiography, which is available on Amazon, titled Shadow and Light, and that was penned in 1902. And then we have Dressmaker, after purchasing her freedom. She started off life as a slave. This is Elizabeth Keckley, spelled with a K. After purchasing her freedom in St. Louis, Elizabeth Keckley moved to Washington, D.C. and became a dressmaker for Mary Todd Lincoln, producing elegant gowns for the Capitol's elite women. These selections from her 1868 autobiography, Behind the Scenes, display her ardor and initiative in creating a business and her life. Now, my grandmother on my mother's side only had like a fifth or sixth education, grade education. She and my grandfather had seven children. He was blind. And I lived with my grandparents for a year when I was like in second grade in New Orleans. And I can't recall her going out, or either her or my grandfather going out for a 9-to-5 paycheck job. They were there at that house all day. And I had an aunt, one of the seven children, my Aunt Vivian, she lived with us. Now, she had a 9-to-5. She worked in a laundromat. Well, yeah, laundry. But thinking back on it, my grandmother, it was six girls and one boy. That's what they had. And from what I hear, is my grandmother taught all her children. I don't know if she taught my uncle, but all the girls, she taught them how to sew clothes, how to make clothes before they left the house. Because my mother left home at 17. But my mother left home, she had the skill set of a seamstress. They knew how to make their own patterns. My mother could look at something. My grandmother taught her this. She can look at any type of garment, coat, slacks, shirt, look at it and make a pattern and make that coat, slack, shirt, what have you. She later became, my mother later became a nurse, RN, registered nurse. And when she was doing, she also became a nurse entrepreneur when she had private duty cases. I remember when I was little, she always used to carry her sewing with her to the job. Because a lot of patients, she just had to watch and monitor throughout the night. But I imagine I heard stories of my grandmother, you know, she had to sometimes go catch fish to feed the family. Once again, my grandfather was, he was blind. I actually had to talk to one of my cousins about, most I heard out of him, he would preach every now and then. But I imagine my grandmother not only made clothes for her family, because my mother did that in part. She probably made clothes in her business, side hustle, whatever you want to call it, was somebody needed a whatever coat. They would come to her. Gertrude Smith was her name. And I imagine that's how that was her cash business. Only a fifth or sixth grade education. And I imagine her mother, who I met, my great-grandmother, lived to be, I've heard 90 stories of 99 to as high as 102. She lived on 88 acres, which that 88 acres is still in the family. I imagine it was her mother who taught her how to sew. So with Elizabeth Keckley, that's what I think about. So that is other ventures enslaved people were able to start a business while slavery was still legal in this country, but legally earn and we'll like so throughout the month we'll feature other people. Now today, Edwin R. Overall. Let's read up on him. I'm going from Wikipedia. Edwin R. Overall, also known as Edwin R. Williams, born August 25th, 1835. Sunset, July 31st, 1901, was an abolitionist, civil rights activist, civil servant, and politician in Chicago and Omaha, Nebraska. In the 1850s and 60s, he was involved in the abolition of the in abolition and Underground Railroad activities, and headed the Chicago's Quinchapel AME Church. During the Civil War, he recruited blacks in Chicago to join the Union Army. After the war, he was the first black in Nebraska to be nominated to the state legislature in 1890. He lost the election in 1892, but he was the first. Hold on, this is another person, and we'll feature him another day. All right. Okay, there's a lot on him. Let's get to the energy CEO. Let's see. Okay, all right, after the war, no, we don't want that part. Well, let me go from memory. How did he become an energy CEO? Because he did quite a number of things, quite a bit of things. No, we don't want the civil rights era. Let's see. Organized labor. Well, let me see here. I'll go from here. In 1880, he was chairman of the Colored Campaign Club in Omaha, Nebraska, along with Dr. W.H.C. Stevens and others. Later that year, Stevenson and Overall sought a selection at the convention of black Republicans to be put forward in state legislature. Let's see. All right, in the 1880s, he became active in organized labor, joined the Knights of Labor. Hold it now, the part that I'm looking for. Here we go. Post-war Chicago, after the war, Overall continued to work for the advancement of blacks and civil rights. October 16, 1866, he served as chairman of the Chicago delegation to a convention of the colored Americans of the state of Illinois in Galensburg, Illinois. Let's see. All right. All right, oh, man, I thought it would. All right, long story short, here we go. I found it. All right. In 1875, his father died, and Overall was awarded his father's fortune. It was at this time that he changed his name from Williams to Overall. All right. With this inheritance and his own business, he became Omaha's wealthiest citizen. He didn't say black Omaha. He said Omaha, Nebraska's wealthiest citizen. He invested widely in real estate and was director and later president of the Missouri and Nebraska Coal Mining Company. The company mine was 16 miles from Plattsmouth. Overall's work brought him into contact with many friends who visited him in Omaha, including Paul Lawrence Dunbar. His close relationship with the city government and military placed him on the reception committee for the visit of Ulysses S. Grant to Omaha in 1879. Okay, so anyway, that went on Overall. He inherited some wealth, became an energy, and I say energy executive because coal does produce energy. So and you can read about him online. Now, Wikipedia has him listed as abolitionist, civil rights activist, mail carrier, and politician. But if you read through the Wikipedia piece, he was an energy company with the coal mine executive. He eventually ran the company. And he became wealthy via inheritance. tomorrow we'll feature another person that, like I say, the majority of people that we're going to feature were born slaves. Probably not all of them will be, some will probably have been born free, but the period that they were born free, there was still a whole, you know, a lot of lynching going on in the United States. So, all right, we'll be back to the phone lines in about 3 or 4 minutes.
From the past, how long can a good thing last? From Slavery, Chapter 10, A Harder Task Than Making Bricks Without Straw. From the very beginning at Tuskegee, I was determined to have the students do not only the agricultural and domestic work, but to have them erect their own buildings. My plan was to have them, while performing a service, taught the latest and best methods of labor, so that the school would not only get the benefit of their efforts, but the students themselves would be taught to see not only the utility in labor, but beauty and dignity. Would be taught, in fact, how to lift labor up from the mere drudgery and toil, and would learn to love work for its own sake. My plan was not to teach them the work in the old way, but to show them how to make the forces of nature, air, water, steam, electricity, horsepower, assist them in their labor. At first, many advised against the experiment of having the buildings erected by the labor of the students, but I was determined to stick to it. I told those who doubted the wisdom of the plan that I knew that our first buildings would not be so comfortable or so complete in their finish as buildings erected by the experienced hands of outside workmen, but that in the teaching of civilization, self-help, and self-reliance, the erection of the buildings by the students themselves would more than compensate for any lack of comfort or fine finish. I further told those who doubted the wisdom of the plan that the majority of our students came to us in poverty, from the cabins of the cotton, sugar, and rice plantations of the South. And that while I knew that it would please the students very much to place them at once in finely constructed buildings, I felt that it would be following out of more natural process of development to teach them how to construct their own buildings. Mistakes I knew would be made, but these mistakes would teach us valuable lessons for the future. During the now 19 years existence of the Tuskegee School, the plan of having the buildings erected by student labor has been adhered to. In this time, 40 buildings, counting small and large, have been built, and all except four are almost wholly the product of student labor. As an additional result, hundreds of men are now scattered throughout the South who receive their knowledge of mechanics while being taught how to erect these buildings. Skill and knowledge are now handed down from one set of students to another in this way, until at the present time, a building of any description or size can be constructed wholly by our instructors and students, from the drawing of the plans to the putting in of the electric fixtures, without going off the grounds for a single workman. Not a few times when a new student has been led into the temptation of marring the looks of some building by lead pencil marks or by the cuts of a jackknife, I have heard an old student remind him, "Don't do that. That is our building, and I helped to put it up." In the early days of the school, I think my most trying experience was in the matter of brick making. As soon as we got the farm work reasonably well started, we directed our next efforts toward the industry of making bricks. We needed these for use in connection with the erection of our own buildings, but there was also another reason for establishing this industry. There was no brickyards in the town. And in addition to our own needs, there was a demand for bricks in the general market. I had always sympathized with the children of Israel in their task of making bricks without straw. But ours was a task of making bricks with no money and no experience. In the first place, the work was hard and dirty, and it was difficult to get the students to help. When it came to brickmaking, their distaste for manual labor in connection with book education became especially manifest. It was not a pleasant task for one to stand in the mud pit for hours with the mud up to his knees. More than one man became disgusted and left the school. We tried several locations before we opened up a pit that furnished brick clay. I had always supposed that brickmaking was a very simple, but I soon found out by bitter experience that it required special skill and knowledge, particularly in the burning of the bricks. After a good deal of effort, we molded about 25,000 bricks and put them into a kiln to be burned. This kiln turned out to be a failure because it was not properly constructed or properly burned. We began at once, however, on a second kiln. Now, this for some reason also proved a failure. The failure of this kiln made it still more difficult to get the students to take any part in the work. Several of the teachers, however, who had been trained in the industries at Hampton, volunteered their services, and in some way we succeeded in getting a third kiln ready for burning. Now, the burning of a kiln requires about a week. Toward the latter part of the week, when it seemed as if we were going to have a good many thousand bricks in a few hours, in the middle of the night, the kiln fell. For the third time, we had failed. The failure of this last kiln left me without a single dollar with which to make another experiment. Most of the teachers advised the abandoning of the effort to make bricks. In the midst of my troubles, I thought of a watch which had come into my possession years ago. I took this watch to the city of Montgomery, which was not far distant. I placed it in a pawn shop. I secured cash upon it to the amount of $15 with which to renew the brickmaking experiment. I returned to Tuskegee, and with the help of the $15, rallied our rather demoralized and discouraged forces and began a fourth attempt to make bricks. This time, I am glad to say we were successful. Before I got a hold of any money, the time limit on the watch had expired, and I've never seen it since. But I have never regretted the loss of it. Brickmaking has now become such an important industry at the school that last season, our students manufactured 1,200,000 of first-class bricks of a quality suitable to be sold in any market. Aside from this, the scores of young men have mastered the brickmaking trade, both the making of bricks by hand and by machinery, and are now engaged in the industry in many parts of the South. The making of these bricks taught me an important lesson in regard to the relations of the two races in the South. Many white people who had no contact with the school, and perhaps no sympathy with it, came to us to buy bricks because they found out that ours were good bricks. They discovered that we were supplying a real want in the community. The making of these bricks caused many of the white residents of the neighborhood to begin to feel that the education of the Negro was not making him worthless, but in educating our students, we were adding something to the wealth and comfort of the community. As the people of the neighborhood came to us to buy bricks, we got acquainted with them. They traded with us and we with them. Our business interests became intermingled. We had something which what they wanted. They had something which we wanted. This in a large measure helped to lay the foundation for the pleasant relations that have continued to exist between us and the white people in that section, and which now extended throughout the South. Wherever one of the brick makers has gone in the South, we find that he has something to contribute to the well-being of the community into which he has gone, something that has made the community feel that in a degree it is indebted to him and perhaps to a certain extent dependent upon him. In this way, pleasant relations between the races have been stimulated. My experience is that there is something in human nature which always makes an individual recognize and reward merit, no matter under what color of skin merit is found. I have found, too, that it is the visible and tangible that goes a long ways in softening prejudices. The actual sight of a first-class house that a Negro has built is 10 times more potent than pages of discussion about a house that he ought to build, or perhaps could build. The same principle of industrial education has been carried out in the building of our own wagons, carts, and buggies from the first. We now own and use on our farm and about the school dozens of these vehicles, and every one of them has been built by the hands of the students. Aside from this, we help supply the local market with the vehicles. The supplying of them to the people in the community has had the same effect as the supplying of bricks, and a man who learns at Tuskegee to build and repair wagons and carts is regarded as a benefactor by both races in the community where he goes. The people with whom he lives and works are going to think twice before they part with such a man. The individual who can do something that the world wants done will, in the end, make his way regardless of his race. One man may go into the community prepared to supply the people there with an analysis of Greek sentences. The community may not at all that time be prepared for it or feel the need of Greek analysis, but it may feel its needs of bricks and houses and wagons. If the man can supply the need for those, then it will lead eventually to a demand for the first product, and with the demand will come the ability to appreciate it and to profit by it. About the time that we succeeded in burning our first kiln of bricks, we began facing in an emphasized form the objection of the students to being taught to work. By this time, it had gotten to be pretty well advertised throughout the state that every student who came to Tuskegee, no matter what his financial ability might be, must learn some industry. Quite a number of letters came from parents protesting against their children engaging in labor while they were in school. Other parents came to the school to protest in person. Most of the new students brought a written or verbal request from their parents to the effect that they wanted their children taught nothing but books. The more books, the larger they were, and the longer the titles printed upon them, the better pleased the students and their parents seemed to be. I gave little heed to those protests, except that I lost no opportunity to go into as many parts of the state as I could for the purpose of speaking to the parents and showing them that the value of industrial education. Besides, I talked to the students constantly on the subject. Notwithstanding the unpopularity of industrial work, the school continued to increase in numbers to such an extent that by the middle of the second year, there was an attendance of about 150, representing almost all parts of the state of Alabama, and including a few from other states. In the summer of 1882, Ms. Davidson and I both went north and engaged in the work of raising funds for the completion of our new building. On my way north, I stopped in New York to try to get a letter of recommendation from an officer of a missionary organization who had become somewhat acquainted with me a few years previous. This man was not only refused to give me the letter, but advised me most earnestly to go back home at once and not make an attempt to get money, for he was quite sure that I would never get more than enough to pay my traveling expenses. I thanked him for his advice and proceeded on my journey. The first place I went to the north was Northampton, Massachusetts, where I spent nearly a half day in looking for a colored family with whom I could board, never dreaming that any hotel would admit me. I was greatly surprised when I found that I would have no trouble in being accommodated at a hotel. We were successful in getting money enough so that on Thanksgiving Day of that year, we held our first service in the chapel of Porter Hall, although the building was not completed. In looking about for someone to preach the Thanksgiving sermon, I found one of the rarest men that it has ever been my privilege to know. This was Reverend Robert C. Bedford, a white man from Wisconsin, who was the pastor of a little colored congregational church in Montgomery, Alabama. Before going to Montgomery to look for someone to preach the sermon, I had never heard of Mr. Bedford, and he had never heard of me. He gladly consented to come to Tuskegee and hold a Thanksgiving service. It was the first service of the kind that the colored people there had ever observed, and what a deep interest they manifested in it. The sight of the new building made it a day of Thanksgiving for them, never to be forgotten. Mr. Bedford consented to become one of the trustees of the school, and in that capacity, and as a worker for it, he has been connected with it for 18 years. During this time, he has borne the school upon his heart night and day, and is never so happy as when he is performing some service, no matter how humble for it. He completely obliterates himself in everything and looks only for permission to serve where service is most disagreeable and where others would not be attracted. He In all my relations with him, he has seemed to me to approach as nearly to the spirit of the master as almost any man I ever met. A little later, there came into the service of school another man, quite young at the time, and fresh from Hampton, without whose service the school never could have become what it is, and this was Mr. Warren Logan, who now for 17 years has been the treasurer of the Institute and the acting principal during my absence. He has always shown a degree of unselfishness and an amount of business tact, coupled with a clear judgment, that has kept the school in good condition, no matter how long I have been absent from it. During all the financial stress through which the school has passed, his patience and faith in our ultimate success have not left him. As soon as our first building was near enough to completion so that we could occupy a portion of it, which was nearly the middle of the second year of the school, we opened a boarding department. Students had begun coming from quite a distance and in such increasing numbers that we felt more and more that we were merely skimming over the surface and that we were not getting a hold of the students in their home life. We had nothing but the students and their appetites with which to begin a boarding department. No provision had been made in the new building for a kitchen and dining room, but we discovered that by digging out a large amount of earth from under the building, we could make a partially lighted basement room that could be used for a kitchen and a dining room. Again, I called on the students to volunteer for work, this time to assist in digging out the basement. This they did, and in a few weeks we had a place to cook and eat in, although it was very rough and uncomfortable. Anyone seeing the place now would never believe that it was once used for a dining room. The most serious problem, though, was to get the boarding department started off in running order. With nothing to do within the way of furniture and with no money with which to buy anything, the merchants in the town would let us have the food that we wanted on credit. In fact, in those early years, I was constantly embarrassed because people seemed to have more faith in me than I had in myself. It was pretty hard to cook, however, without stoves, and awkward to eat without dishes. At first, the cooking was done outdoors and in old-fashioned, primitive style in pots and skillets placed over a fire. Some of the carpenter's benches that had been used in the construction of the building were utilized for tables. As for dishes, there were too few to make it worthwhile to spend time in describing them. Not one connected with the boarding department seemed to have any idea that meals must be served at certain fixed and regular hours, and that was a source of great worry. Everything was so out of joint and so inconvenient that I feel safe in saying that there for the first 2 weeks, something was wrong at every meal. Either the meat was not done or we had been burnt, or the salt had been left out of the bread or the tea had been forgotten. Early one morning, I was standing near the dining room door listening to the complaints of the students. The complaints that morning were especially emphatic and numerous because the whole breakfast had been a failure. One of the girls who had failed to get any breakfast came out and went to the well to draw some water to drink to take the place of breakfast, which she had not been able to get. When she reached the well, she found that the rope was broken and that she could get no water. She turned from the well and said in the most discouraged tone, not knowing that I was where I could hear her, "We can't even get water to drink at this school." I think no one remark ever came so near discouraging me as that one. At another time when Mr. Bedford, whom I had already spoken of as one of our trustees and devoted friend of the institution, was visiting the school, he was given a bedroom immediately over the dining room. Early in the morning, he was awakened by a rather animated discussion between two boys in the dining room below. The discussion was over the question as to whose turn it was to use the coffee cup that morning. One boy won the case by proving that for 3 mornings he had not had an opportunity to use the cup at all. But gradually, by patience and hard work, we brought order out of chaos, just as will be true of any problem if we stick to it with patience and wisdom and earnest effort. As I look back now over the part of our struggle, I'm glad that we had it. I'm glad that we endured all those discomforts and inconveniences. I'm glad that our students had to dig out the place for the kitchen and dining room. I'm glad that our first boarding place was in that dismal, ill-lighted, and damp basement. Had we started in a fine, attractive, convenient room, I fear we would have lost our heads and become stuck up. It means a great deal, I think, to start off on a foundation which one has made for oneself. When our old students return to Tuskegee now, as they often do, and go into our large, beautiful, well-ventilated, and well-lighted dining room and see tempting, well-cooked food, largely grown by the students themselves, and see tables, neat tablecloths and napkins and vases of flowers upon the tables, and hear singing birds, and note that each meal is observed exactly upon the minute, with no disorder and with almost no complaint coming from the hundreds that now fill our dining room, they too often say to me that they were glad that we started as we did and built ourselves up over year by year by a slow and natural process of growth.
Okay, that was reading of Chapter 10 from the book written by Booker T. Washington. I'm going to call him a slave entrepreneur, too. Up from slavery, but that was Chapter 10. In any event, let's see. Before we go to the phone lines here, just a little trending topics here. One of the trending topics is Nevada mother arrested for child abuse after cops find kids sharing a room with 18 dogs. We got a solution for that one, but we'll report it when we've completed it. In any event, let's go to the phone lines real quick here on Slave Entrepreneur Month. 314, your mic is open.
Hey, Ellie, how you doing, man?
I'm doing much better that this weather is warmed up down here. We've gone from 32 to 35 degrees in the morning to, I got up to 78 yesterday.
Oh, my grandson got a baseball tournament this weekend.
Okay, well, he'll be busy. Well, yeah, I mean, he's busy most days of the week anyway.
Yeah, it's going to show you the difference in the temperature. It's nice down here.
Yeah, I just came from outside. It's supposed to get up to 80 today, I guess. I got the doors and windows open, so because it was colder inside the house at one time than it was outside. So get the chill.
I like this guy. I like this character. It would.
Overall,
he was a mulatto. Yeah, he was a mulatto. He was mixed. Hey, LA, when did the segregation end in public schools?
Man, I could not tell you that. I had to go to my computer for that one.
Wasn't it Brown something?
Let's see. Well, let me look that up.
Brown.
Year segregation, and this country is, in my opinion, to a high degree, self-segregated. You know, certain people live on this side of town versus the other side of town. And all right, the Civil Rights Act of 1964 superseded all state and local laws requiring segregation. Compliance.
What about that other one that Thurgood Marshall participated in?
Brown
decision.
Brown versus Board of Education? Yeah.
Yeah. What year was that?
All right, education date, May 17, 1954.
So that's when schools was segregation ended in the United States. That what
well,
you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, that's a lie. Because in 1869, with the help of Edwin R. Overhaul, Omaha desegregated schools.
First in the country then.
Well, I would guess 1869 comes before 1954, right?
It comes way before that.
So how in the heck do we get this thing? You know what happened is the NAACP hijacked that event.
Mm-hmm.
Or should I say that fact?
Right. Yeah, well, one interesting thing about one... Go ahead, listen.
Read about Mr. Overall, and I think that picture that they show is not him. I think that's Matthew Ricketts' picture.
Yeah, that's the thing about when you run across these entrepreneurs or these historical figures. A lot of times the picture might not be accurate. Because I know with
that's
Sarah
Matthew
Rector
Ricketts.
As an adult woman, there's one picture of her that's not her. So a lot of this stuff you got to piece together.
Yeah, that's Matthew Ricketts' picture.
Okay, now I'm not familiar with him, Matthew Ricketts.
And, you know, here's another thing. They formed the Afro-American League, as it was called then, the National African-American League. You got people... you got some of these voices that say, well, we was called Negro, we was called African-American, we was called colored, and all. No. And when they say African-American was created by who? Jesse Jackson. Was Jesse Jackson born back in 1890?
No, but, you know, people take it. If he said it, a lot of people just take his word for it.
I'm going to give you some good critical theory. I just gave you 2 points there.
I'm looking at Matthew O. Ricketts right now.
The desegregated, well, go down to where it says Civil Rights in Omaha.
Okay.
Are you there?
Let me scroll down. I had a page open already. Civil Rights in Omaha. Yeah, I got it.
All right.
In the late 1860s, Overall moved to Omaha, where he continued the civil rights activism and civic involvement. When he arrived, Omaha schools were segregated, and education for blacks was very poor. In 1868, he led a fight to end segregation, and in 1869, the system ended.
What system?
Segregation.
Of what?
In schools.
Oh, my goodness. That ain't what you taught.
No,
you
that's
taught
not what
that Thurgood Marshall and NAACP done that. In
1954. You're absolutely right. They hijacked that. You're right.
Oh, my goodness. Critical race theory. Ooh-wee.
You're right, they got a picture of Ricketts up here on the at the top they got Edwin R. Overall, that picture, and then
I think
they got a picture of Ricketts.
I don't know.
They
you
got
have
a picture
to
of Ricketts under the civil rights stuff.
Go down about the African American League.
Okay, I'm there now.
There were disagreement over the local league's constitution. While Adams supported Overall, Ricketts, Walker, and Bell loudly opposed Overall's domination of the writing of the constitution. Ricketts initially opposed the idea that whites could be allowed in the league, fearing they would dominate it. But Walker supported their cause convincingly. They didn't want whites in the league. For what? They feared that they would dominate. Okay. So what is the difference with the NFL not wanting blacks in the league? I mean, is that a logical point, assumption? Whites didn't want blacks involved. Blacks didn't want whites involved. That even continue right on today. I mean, that's just a thing.
People are tribal. That's the way I look at it.
Yeah, but here, but the reason here is because they were feared that whites would dominate the league. The same kind of stuff that Malcolm X used to talk about. So if whites come along and say they feared letting blacks in, that they would dominate this, that, or the other, I mean, what's the difference? It's the same cordial feeling. It's natural.
Yeah.
Was these blacks racist because they didn't want whites in the league? Well, if you want to look at the
sounds like a double standard.
Yeah, the definition of racism wasn't that way back then, but now it's damn near encompassed everything. If you scratch your damn head, it's racist in some cases. But we can say it was. They was racist back then, too. Like Whoopi Goldberg just recently. Was she not a racist for making the comments that she made?
Now, you know what? Here's my time. I'm glad you brought that up. If it wasn't for this theme this month I'm doing, I heard her original statement, and her point of view was man's inhumanity to man. She just wiped out the whole thing, but some people, well, you know what?
Well, in this climate, she said that Nazis and Jews were both white, trying to say that it was white on white.
Yeah, she did say that, and she was right.
That's where she was going. See, I know where she was going with this thing about white on white crime. That's where she was going. Nazis and Jews were both white.
They were both white.
That's where she was going. So that's a racist statement, what she made. Because if you did the same thing with Donald Trump, or did the same thing with blacks, by a white person saying that, it would be considered as racist. I tell you something else, too, about Mr. Edwin Overall. He was a Republican, by the way, right?
Oh, yeah. Most of the blacks back then were Republicans.
Well, this was coming up into
Booker T. Washington, Republican. All of them that I've gone through are Republican.
And they had some good points. And like you say, they went on and done what work they wanted to do. And, you know, here's another thing, too. This usage of the word slave, it's totally been misconstrued. Because have you ever heard of what we call free slaves?
Well, that doesn't even make any sense, free slaves.
Yes, it does, because it was used like that, because the definition person that was a slave was a whole encompass, especially in Africa. A slave could have been a house servant. A slave could have been a captain of war.
Right.
A slave could have been a slave. In Africa, they was elevated to the stool in the Akan. The stool is a very high position, but they were still slaves. And when they were released from that bondage, some of them didn't want to go. They would like to remain in the status that they were or in the company that they was in. Actually, when you looked at somebody, if you was in another environment and you looked at somebody with that phenotypical features, you would basically first say, there's a slave. Although it may be a free slave. You know, slaveholders and slave owners had to convince free workers to work for them And you know how they done so?
How's that?
With higher wages, especially on the railroads. Blacks worked on a railroad,
mm-hmm.
and they could have left anytime they got ready. Railroads spanned miles. So how you going? And see, here's another thing. Slaveholders had to have an additional expense on plantation, and that additional expense was slave catchers. Because they surely wasn't going to go out and do it for free, right?
No. Mm-mm. Well, it takes money to travel because some of these slave catchers had to go to the next town or to the next state.
And also, along the Carolinas, you had Indians who were in the business of slave catching. Wonder why, L.A.? Well, for the same reason that Indians didn't make good slaves. What was the excuse that people said that we can't use these Indians? Because they know the land.
Well, they did know the land.
They know all the nooks and crooks and caverns and caves and hiding places. So they made good slave catchers because if the slaves tried to run away in unfamiliar territory,
I know where they are.
Yeah, I know where we are. Let's go get them. How much you want for them? And you say, here's another thing, too. The practice of societies back during those days, the person considered a slave was really property, right?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. So when you had abolitionists that was leading, trying to help slaves escape, that was really a crime because what were they doing? It was stealing property.
Right. Grand larceny, I guess.
If it wasn't so, then why did the U.S. government pay Indians to release their what? Their property, Indian tribes.
Mm-hmm.
Abolitionists couldn't go to the Indian tribe and run off with them because the Indians couldn't find them. So if you can pay one for the release of the property, should not the other be compensated for the release of their property too?
Yeah.
I mean, they got them all on the pretense that they were what? Property. You went down to the market and you picked out what you wanted. Another business was inspectors who would inspect the property. Just like when you go to the car auction today and you buy a vehicle, you can get a warranty on that vehicle as far as them guaranteeing the engine, transmission, and drivetrain. And you can have an inspector or somebody to inspect it. Or you can get inspecting records that this here showed to be in good shape and this here showed to be in good shape. So, well, they done the same thing with that property, too.
Mm-hmm.
You ever had a car that you wanted to sell to somebody, L.A., or put it up for sale?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
What all did you do to that car to make it look nice?
Well, you got to wash it, get it cleaned up, polished.
There you go. You polish it. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the same way they done. That's the way the owners done that property, too. They washed it. In Ghana, there's a place, a river, what they call I think it's in that area called Takoradi. It's where is where the slaves took their last bath before going down into Accra, where they were taken to the market.
Mm-hmm.
They were shined up with I don't know what kind of grease that they put on. And they also had sulfur put on, a powder. You know what that did, don't you? It killed ticks.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So anything you do with your car, you put that blacking on the tires to shine them up. Like you say, you wax it. Make sure that the inspector come and check it and make sure that the windshield wipers work, the brake light work, the turn signals work. That was making sure your property was in a condition that would be appeasing for the potential buyer. And that's the same way they done with the property, human property, that went on to be called slaves under many different situations. And really the word has been taken out of context in many cases, because when somebody say slave, what do you think about? Somebody working in the field from can't see
right.
to can't see. So on and so on and so on. It's been misconstrued. And it's been
I'm looking up the vocabulary of, because we call them slaves, but back
look
then
the
they
etymology.
Weren't called it.
Look up the etymology of the word, and it tells you as much as it possibly can. Then you got to go to what others ethnic groups did in other countries, like in Africa. Of course, it had in different languages, different words, but what did they mean? Like we tell you, you had the word pawn. Some slaves were P-A-W-N-S. That's like the pawn shop. What did you do at a pawn shop? You take stuff there and you let them hold it as a way, as a collateral for borrowing what? Money.
I got the etymology of slavery. The term slave, S-L-A-V-E, has its origins in the word Slav, S-L-A-V. Of course, if you pronounce it like an Eastern European, it would say Slav. I didn't pronounce it. They pronounce it slave.
What color
the
were they?
The Slavs were who inhabited a large part of Eastern Europe, and they're Slavic people today, were taken as slaves by Muslims in Spain during the 9th century A.D.
What color were they, L.A.?
White, all white.
Skin color. Oh,
all
my
white.
Goodness. That can't possibly be from
all
what
white.
We've told. L.A., you are now doing what I call critical race theory. Eastern Europe. Actually, you're talking about Western.
Poland, Romania, Moldova, Ukraine, all those are Slavic lands.
Also, you had another area, what was Western, and actually it was Asia. It wasn't Europe at that time. Maybe it was. But Europe was not a continent. Continent definition was a body of land surrounded by water. Europe is not,
no, that's
totally
not Europe at all. Yeah.
Right. There at Gibraltar, you ever heard of the term Barbary?
Yeah, the Barbary Coast.
Barbary Coast. You ever heard of the term Barbary Pirates?
I've heard of them.
Okay. Well, when you had American ships trying to go through the Straits of Gibraltar, on past the Barbary Coast, on past a area that was famous in a song, or should I say a slogan, for a fighting group called the Marines. From the shores of Montezuma. You know what Montezuma they was talking about? They were talking about Mexico, capital of Mexico.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
To the hall from the halls of Montezuma to the shores
of Tripoli.
Tripoli. Where are they talking about Tripoli? That's Libya.
Right. Northern Africa.
Yes. And those were big trading outposts where you could buy white slaves, just like you buy black slaves. And you know that about most of the slaves coming out of the west coast of Africa went to Brazil and the Caribbean. A small percentage came to the United States. Some people, some historians, records say 5%.
Yeah, USA was the last stop.
Yeah, they say 5%.
Well, North America was the last stop, I'll put it that way.
North America, yes. And you only had less than 3% of whites had anything to do with slavery on the eve of the Civil War. Cotton wasn't introduced into the Americas until the late 1700s. Matter of fact, when the Constitution was ratified, I don't even think cotton was even in the Americas. What you had was sugarcane, tobacco. Mm-hmm. And that was basically in the Caribbean because the environment, temperature was more conducive for it rather than in the United States. What temperature you got in Florida now? 30-some-odd degrees.
Well, that was 2 days ago. Now it's up to 80, 78, 80 now.
Sugarcane and tobacco don't like that, man. They don't like that. Tobacco is very hard on the soil. Who talked about that? George Washington Carver talked about how tobacco depletes the hell out of the soil. You had your first president, what was his name? George Washington.
Yeah, George Washington.
George Washington had some slaves. The work here, tobacco, and indigo.
Yeah, Mount Vernon, Virginia, I've been out to that place about 2 times.
Right. It was a damn near a total failure. Because indigo don't like growing in the state. So it wasn't profitable for him. He lost money. And Dutch, much was business when you went into it. You hope to, but that don't necessarily mean that you would make money. So it's a lot to these stories, whereas you got certain groups that only want to tell one side. That ain't no critical race. That's lopsided bias.
Right.
My hat goes off to Edwin R. Overall, because within his story is a lot of information that people don't know about.
Well, the desegregation, I'm glad you pointed that out, because the NAACP, they, like you said, hijacked that and didn't give credit where credit was due.
No, they didn't. They did not. And also the fact that they formed the local league called the National African American League because they want to give that term to Jesse Jackson as the first one to coin. Critical race theory, L.A., where's Robin at today?
I spoke to her probably about. She had some type of. She had to go to the emergency room like 2 weeks ago. Nothing serious. They checked out and everything, but she probably turned wrong or whatever. So I think she's physically back to 100%. But she's basically resting up. I spoke to about 30 minutes before the podcast today, 30 minutes an hour before the podcast. So she's basically been. She's doing better. You know, she says she's just resting up because she was going at it 7 days a week.
Right.
So.
Now you got another person that you play is Fuller Jr.
Mm-hmm.
His conversation is totally misleading also. About the railroad.
I agree. I just played that one part because of the railroads. I mean, the shotgun houses. That's I'm going to have to do my own version of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Because he's using that as an example in saying that blacks, there's no whites take out no ability for blacks to be able to learn how to do industrial arts. They did not, at least in St. Louis. That school board done that themselves. And the
well, that's probably in most places. Black. Yeah.
I mean, and I know another reason, because you had other schools like Rankin Technical where people had to pay to go to after they graduated from high school, those that didn't come through the industrial arts. But industrial arts didn't really teach you how to build no damn house. Industrial arts taught you how to make wood carvings and pepper, salt and pepper shakers out of wood. A block of wood with drilling holes in it, putting a cork in the bottom, and drilling holes perpendicular to the cavity so that the salt or pepper can come out. That wasn't teaching you about breaking, building a house, but even if it's so, whites didn't take that away. Blacks didn't have that. You had the schools there in St. Louis called charter schools, construction training charter school, where in the charter school, the students was exposed to hands-on the activities that goes on a construction site. Now, I don't know if this school is still in existence, but nobody took that away from black folks. And another point, nobody's going to be learning how to build no shotgun houses. That just ain't it. Who in the heck is going to buy a shotgun house? Think about it, L.A.
Well, you're right. I figure people that built those shotgun houses, they probably, that was their personal place to live.
That's something you see. Well, you've seen it all over. And what they mean with a shotgun, it was straight through. A wall on one side, a wall on another side, and that was it. Your person come in the front door with a shotgun and shoot, you kill everybody between the front door and the back door. That's why they call it a shotgun house.
And so, they didn't own the land. That was railroad land, as he said.
Well, yeah, it was railroad land. But you know, when the Transcontinental Railroad was built, and it was built by a lot of people, especially Panamanians.
Well, they had a lot of, what do you call it, tent towns, didn't they? Little tent settlements.
They had tent settlements, and they also had those houses like the greatest little whorehouse in town. What do you call that stuff?
Oh, a little bit in Texas or something?
The greatest whorehouse in Texas. Well, they had those type of entertainment places, brothels, that set up around those railroad towns. Not railroad towns, but around the railroad construction.
Yeah, and you're right, because I saw a TV show where they were building the railroad and, you know, they would set up, you know, basically a tent. Most of the buildings were tents. If you saw a wood building with a little structure to it, that could have been a saloon, that type of setup. But the workers, lot of them set up tents.
You know, one thing that was a detriment to the Transcontinental Railroad at that time was the fuel, and all the fuel, the burners, and for the first produced the fire to produce the steam. And it was trees. So all along the railroad, you see where trees was cut down because they needed that fuel. Until later on, it went to coal.
Right.
And they had those little towns with all kinds of stuff going on in them, gambling, drinking, prostitution.
Everything.
Of course, you got men. Men was horny.
Very low on what we call today law and order.
Right. You had blacks that worked on the railroad. They were not slaves. You had the blacks that came out of Panama who had worked on what project, L.A.?
Panama Canal.
Panama. The Panama Canal. Absolutely.
You also
see, man,
had
Chinese. You know your history.
Chinese work on
Chinese workers too. Chinese was good in tunneling. And they would come over as a group and be hired. And they got paid because they had a strike. They wanted more money, which they got. And they prepared their own particular type of food, which proved to be beneficial because they would not suffer the type of internal intestinal problems that the other workers were suffering from. And that was because you went from one area to the other and you was being exposed to bacteria in that that you weren't used to.
Right.
I mean, that's just normal. Go walking through, set up camp in the Sahara Desert and let a rain come along and reactivate that bacteria and see what happens. You're going to get sick if you're not used to it.
Right.
Same thing when they used to open up tombs, and they still do. If they find a tomb and they open it up, the entrance, they don't walk up in there right away. They let the door stay open for almost a week or more to let the air change because the air in there will kill you.
Mm.
And people call it a curse. Well, maybe it was a curse. People go in there and all of a sudden fall out on the floor dead. They say it was a curse.
They didn't let the place air out.
Yeah.
First.
You got to. Because that those bacteria and spores is still living. Or they had the ability to come back.
Right.
And rain will do that in a what appears to be a dry, dead area. Let it rain and see no life come back. Just like it is with a dried up lake bed with clay. Crackle with patties. But when the rain come back, the fish come back because they don't snuggle on down into the ground where it's still moist.
Mm-hmm.
And they basically hibernate. Same thing with bacteria, diseases of old. They still out there. If you present the type of environment and situation, they'll come back. And then you'll be exposed to them. Now, here's the point. At one point in time, the human genome was exposed to that and handled it quite well. That's in your genome archival memory bank. That's your best pharmacy.
I agree. Well, you stay in good health. You're right. Your immune system, it'll take care of you. Well, Bianca, thank you for the filling in those gaps. And we'll be back tomorrow with another person. I don't know who it'll be yet. Plus, we're going to do some, I might do something on white slavery.
Because it did exist.
Yeah, it did exist. And there's several books on it, too. Matter of fact, that's tomorrow. I might cover that. All
hey,
right,
you know,
Jeff,
here's
you have a good day.
Thing.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say, this definition for black has spanned all across the world. See, this guy here wouldn't have been considered black back then. He would have been considered what was the identification of the time. Mm-hmm. And see, as time has went by, like Martin Delaney was almost a jet black person. This guy here, he's a mulatto.
Right.
Probably, and you got some like Phyllis Wheatley was damn near white. She could pass for white. But today, mentality, they call anything that's not lily white black. And
that's
that there is really a misjustice because it's confusing.
That's true, double standard. Well, beyond a double standard, actually.
Yeah, Brianna is mixed. That's what she is. Now, people want to claim her as being black. I've heard that stuff. People say that all the time. Go to Yemen. And Yemen ain't going to look at black Americans as no cook. And the people in Yemen And, of course, they've changed. Some of them is jet black, but they've changed. Go to the Northern Sudan. Some of them, practically all of them, is jet black. They ain't looking at black Americans as cousins. Mauritania, they not. I knew a woman here a couple of years ago. Matter of fact, I hit a car. And she was from Mauritania. She didn't look at black, and she's jet black. She didn't look at black Americans as cousins. They are what they are. Thank you very much, Ellie.
Okay, then. Thank you. Everyone have a good rest of the day.